welcome to the Wise Women in Waste podcast series. My name is Debbie Hitchin, and I'm the Director of Sustainable Production and Consumption here at Anthesis. If you've joined us for other episodes of this series, you'll know that my colleague Claudia Amos and I have been interviewing a sample of Wise Women in Waste from across our networks. Following COP26 in Glasgow, we wanted to do something a little bit different. So, for one time only, I'm proud to introduce the Wise Folk in Waste. During this session, Claudia and I will be talking with three of our Anthesis colleagues about the circular economy and what outcomes COP has for the future of sustainable production and consumption globally. But first off, I'd like to give the guests an opportunity to introduce themselves. So we'll just go very quickly round the table, and if everyone can say their name and title and the Anthesis region that they represent, that would be great. Claudia, let's start with you as you're my co-host.
So I'm Claudia Amos. I'm Technical Director at Anthesis. I sit in the UK, but I'm responsible for a global team that works in commercial waste due diligence.
Hello, my name is Berta Mota, and I'm leading the circular economy team, and I'm based in Barcelona in Anthesis Lavola.
Hi, my name is Richard Pegum. I'm on the senior leadership team in the UK representing sustainable products, which covers chemistry, supply chain, manufacturing and retail. I also look after our in-house software team.
Hello, I'm Susan Harris. I'm a technical director here at Anthesis, and I lead our Global Circular Economy Centre of Excellence.
Thanks to you all. I'd like to start the discussion with a question to Susan about the importance of the circular economy as a business concept, as well as a principle of material supply chains, and whether the COP discussions in the first 2 weeks of November are expected to create significant impacts on our future consumption and production and economies globally.
That's a great question, Claudia. I think the answer to whether COP is going to create a significant change is probably not yet, but it must. And I'll tell you why I think that. The upshot of COP is that from the targets and pledges that have been made, we're looking at global warming of around 2.1 degrees, according to the Climate Action Tracker. That's significantly more than 1.8, or ideally the 1.5 that was hoped for. And that 2.1 degree scenario is a really unpleasant one. We're talking regular life-threatening droughts and floods in many regions around the world, significant crises of water, food production, and so on. So, given that nightmarish scenario, why didn't we get a better outcome at COP? And we could say it was because of, say, the presence of the fossil fuel lobby or others. But ultimately, it was because governments, whilst they faced significant pressure from citizens to take real action on climate change, also faced pressure to grow their economies, to provide a prosperous environment for business and a thriving economy and good jobs for citizens, all whilst reducing carbon emissions. And doing both those things at once is difficult. And the same goes in a business context. Delivering on weighty net zero targets whilst growing as a business is a challenge. So to deliver both on the bottom line and on climate and ensure a just transition, we need to change the way we need to do business, the way we use resources. And that requires circular economy, a different approach. The real bottom line is we live on a small planet with a growing population and limited resources. And many studies show there's a tipping point at around 2030 where demand for many key resources will outstrip supply. So we really do need to find ways to decouple economic growth from resource consumption. And I think the good news is that there are many ways we can go about doing that. Just look at the huge amount of waste we see, for example, even in the global food supply chains. This presents a big opportunity for better resource use, more efficient optimization of resources. And additionally, there's potential to improve the impact we have on resource depletion and biodiversity, as well as opportunities for innovation, new business models, new resources, new products, and so on. So I think although it represents a vast challenge, it also represents a real opportunity.
That's great. Thank you very much for outlining the circular economy concept in such detail and also bringing us to the first discussion point about how can we create change, how can we impact it, and how we can really reduce carbon on a day-to-day basis. This might be a good place to bring Richard in to talk a bit more about what a circular economy is and how the opportunities that Susan just mentioned manifest themselves in business and society. Richard, could you provide us with a bit more insight from your work with large global businesses and share examples how businesses can actually benefit from implementing circular principles? So basically, how do you solve this conflict of interest between making money, being viable, being a business, as well as having a positive environmental impact?
Yeah, absolutely. And Susan made some brilliant points, so I'm going to build off of those. A lot of our clients are using circularity as a mechanism to reach their other sustainability goals. And I think this is really important because I don't get too hung up on definitions of what circularity is and isn't. And I don't view it as a goal in of itself, because you could make the perfect circular business model that fits all the academic definitions of what that is. But if that involves infringing on someone's human rights or using a load of scarce resources or increasing carbon, which can happen, then that's not a good outcome. So I think, you know, it's really important that these circular models should serve sustainability goals like improving labor standards in supply chains and reducing carbon and things like that. So we're seeing a lot of reports coming out of the UK recycling industry, for example, even this week, on improper practices like fly tipping and things like modern slavery. They're a lot more insidious and a wider problem in this country. Don't get me wrong, there are some incredibly well-run recycling businesses that are huge contributors to the sustainability of this country and the circular economy. But this idea that just because a business is involved in circularity or adjacent to sustainability in some way, it's inherently virtuous, is a difficult one to justify. They need to be held to exactly the same standards as all the other businesses, because there's just as much scope for things to go wrong. So without a shadow of a doubt, circularity is a brilliant way of making progress on your wider sustainability targets if it's done in the right way and if it meets all of those objectives and those wider considerations like carbon, water, toxicity, etc. So we do a lot of work in the technology sector, as you all know, and our friends over at Fairphone have been making progress in circularity for years. They've been building this circular model on the way that they make parts available for their phones, the way that they design modularity into their phones, upgradability, things like that. That's groundbreaking, and they've done incredibly well. I think they would say so themselves, they've got a relatively small share of the market. But this week, Apple, of all people, have done a complete 180 on these things and have begun making components available to everybody, making diagnostics and all sorts of support available to follow the Fairphone model, which is a sort of groundbreaking achievement. And I think Fairphone probably regard this as a success of theirs. It's a great thing for Apple to be doing, and it just shows the value in these things. So we're seeing real change in the way that products are provided to the markets in sub-segments and the way that people can run these businesses and making this taking off. These are voluntary initiatives. I think some people are doing them before they become compliance-based ones. We've got a bunch of legislation coming in Europe. There's already legislation in the States, which is very clear. There's a direction of travel towards providing consumers with the right to repair their electronics, the right to repair their other devices as well. But by owning it and by making tangible progress on their own, it means that it works for them. So there are very clear business arguments for making these changes. What can a circular business model look like? The reality is it can look like a lot of different things. So I think we spoke earlier about the example of data centers not being particularly circular on their own, but they can provide the services that allowed for dematerialization elsewhere. So in terms of what the basic characteristics of circular outcomes, there's a basic level just making basic stuff that people need, really durable and really good, that lasts for a long time, that you don't need to replace very often, is easy to maintain, and you buy it once and it lasts for 10, 15 years. And I'd argue I've got the world's most sustainable plate sat behind me, because my granddad used to work for ICI and he brought home plates they used for testing the machines they used to print patterns on. This was 40 years ago. And they're still used every day in Peagham households up and down the country. So that's an example of a circular model, right through to the gamut of things. That's Claudia's specialism of like super specialist advanced recycling. So there's a whole thorough of the way these things can look. And the benefits they have are through the real stickiness of people coming back to you because they're built into a service. We're talking to a publisher the other week about the fact that they're reluctant to use recycled material in the way they do books, because their books have to look incredibly beautiful on the shelf. But actually, the bulk of their business is around things like textbooks. And this idea of having circular textbooks, which have to be updated quite a lot because of the versioning, because they don't have to look beautiful, just sort of for sending information and coming back. So that could be quite an interesting way of doing that through that advanced recycling and that stickiness as well. There's a bunch of benefits and ways of doing it and models that are emerging now. So it's quite an exciting time.
Thanks, Richard. You've really brought circularity to life with some of those examples. And I hope that it helps our listeners to understand what we mean in practice when we talk about circular economy and circularity, because I think there's a lot of conversation around this with a lot of business models being used to demonstrate it. But the diversity and the breadth of what you've just shared with us, I think, is really helpful. And recently, I was reading that the value of the circular economy has been estimated at over £1 trillion. So that is a significant opportunity, I think, for businesses and organizations globally to look at how they could take a piece of that and redesign their systems, redesign their business models, such that they could have early mover advantage and indeed the longevity that comes with the sorts of circular economy business models that you've been talking about in those examples. I think I couldn't agree more with what Susan said at the beginning about the need to build a just and fair transition to the sustainable economy, because it's absolutely right that other economies that are still developing have the right and the potential to be able to experience the same economic growth and development that developed nations like the UK, US and Europe have already had. Susan, in your introduction, you said that circularity can make a direct and tangible impact on the wider suite of sustainable development goals. And specifically, you were talking about biodiversity and climate change. So, Berta, I'd be really interested to bring you in at this point and have a conversation with you about how circularity can make a contribution to net zero and therefore climate impact reduction and some of those other sustainable development goals.
Thank you, Debbie. So yeah, it's true that net zero is quite a word that has been resonating for the last couple of years. And in easy words and simple words, it would mean that we cannot emit extra CO2 emissions to the atmosphere more than there is already now. So to reach that, we have to, on the one hand, reduce CO2 by reduction measures. But on the second hand, it means that the remaining emissions, they have to be balanced out. And actually, the goal of that is to limit, as Susan was saying, the global warming to lower than 1.5 Celsius degrees. Because actually, if we are looking at the carbon footprinting of companies, we see that in many, many of the cases, more than 70% of the emissions do relate to scope 3. And this scope is exactly where we find purchased goods and services as one of the main categories. There are many others, but this is one of the ones that bring most of the impact. So actually, it's this scope that is harder to reduce than only shifting to renewable sources of energy, because in fact, these emissions are not under organizations' control. So even if the companies are responsible for those, it's a bit more tricky to handle. So for instance, for a company, it may be tricky or it may be complicated to understand how much water is used in crops, even if they have a nice relationship with their supply chain. But sometimes these are measures and metrics that is hard to find and hard to measure. So yes, we do definitely need to tackle scope 3 to reach a net zero scenario. And this is exactly where circular economy plays a key role. So the aim of circular economy is to meet that gap between the current footprinting scenario and the net zero plan by addressing embodied carbon of goods and services.
So Better, just following on from that, I'd be interested to know how you thought circular economy was represented in COP26.
So actually, we were able to talk to some of our clients who had gone there, and they shared with us that there was a feeling of urgency, so that everything needs to be running quicker and without pause. But despite that, circular economy has not been implicitly in the main agenda of COP26, unfortunately. So it's true that it's a good common space to discuss and keep the momentum going, but in fact, action needs to be taken throughout the whole year. And that means that we need to rethink about the emissions that are being linked to products and services, and that means including design for circularity from the very early stages I was mentioning before. And as you might have guessed, this involves the whole supply chain.
Thank you, Berta. I'm interested in how we might realise some of that £1 trillion worth of value. We've talked a lot about the need for innovation, and clearly that innovation is going to come with a need for investment. Claudia, I know from the work that you've been doing in the Centre of Excellence at Anthesis at that sort of global level, as you described in your introduction, that you're at the forefront of some of that development around industries that are creating the secondary commodities innovation market. Do you agree that there are new models needed for innovation to stimulate the circular economy? And if so, what do you think about the sort of levels of leadership that were shown at the COP26 discussion and that are kind of resonating since that throughout the investment community?
Firstly, I completely agree with Richard that I think there's a lot already moving, and I think a lot of businesses have recognized at very high level that sustainability, climate change, carbon reduction, and their ultimate business goal of running a viable business are not always contradictory to each other, and that they basically need nowadays all those sustainable impact to run a successful business. Because I think what has changed and what has changed again with COP is the urgency that we need to do something. Consumers have really changed and made an impact, which hasn't been the case for a long time, but the last 2 years and maybe in 3 years we have seen that the change in consumer perception, consumer behavior, is directly influences businesses as well as the business to business transactions and the investment sector. And we have also seen funds that have KPIs in terms of, so if they're investing something, part of their KPIs is carbon reduction or certain sustainability commitments. And basically, the funders don't get paid, or they get paid less if they are not achieving those. And I think all of these movements are super important to drive the business into one direction. But I think we still need to strike a balance between the different parts of the hierarchy. So we still have reduce and reuse on the top of the agenda. Then we go into recycling, so secondary commodities like a compost, recycled plastics to reduce our fossil fuel use and carbon emissions, as well as providing carbon offset solutions. Berta just said there are two ways of tackling this. Reduce carbon wherever we can, but then also we will need to offset some of our carbon emissions in areas where it might take a bit longer or it's not that straightforward to do. I think in summary, there's no single solution. We need many different approaches to work together, and also our commitment and the business commitment. And I think that was probably one of the big things that came out of COP26, the urgency that we need to do something and that there's a global community that agrees on that. What was really interesting was the publication from Mark Carney, the UN Special Envoy for Climate Change and Finance, who published a document called Building a Private Finance System for Net Zero, which really prioritizes private finance and their impact and their role in building circular economies and reducing carbons. And right at the front, it says every company, bank, insurer, and investor will have to adjust their business models, develop credible plans for transition, and implement them. And I think that is a key commitment, and that has been signed by over 100 institutions and all the big investors and investment companies. And we can see also with the work we are doing on ESG, on carbon impact, LCAs, mass balancing, that those metrics and those measurements are being used because everybody is getting asked and has to do due diligence on, is it a viable business? What is your carbon impact? Is it a sustainable impact? What are the climate risks? And that's part of the normal due diligence where we need to trace it. And I like to get back to Rich's response on the digital enablers. I think there's a huge power in tracking the data and helping us make the right decisions because, as you mentioned, not just because it's a recycling business, it's a good business. We have seen that different types of recycling businesses have different carbon impacts, different water use, different other environmental impacts. So really creating a better understanding and doing the due diligence to see which projects are having the most positive long-term impact on carbon reduction and resource efficiency is really, really important. And we're all part of supply chains, so we can help make this project viable and attractive for investment. But we need to be very aware and very concerned about potential greenwashing or decisions being made only on one of these metrics. And I think that's where we, other organizations, are really helping to support that.
Thank you, Claudia. And I'd just like to give Richard and Berta and Susan the opportunity to come back in at that point, actually, with any examples of businesses that have managed to successfully establish a circular economy model and link that very clearly to their net zero and other sustainable development goals. So I don't know if anybody would like to just jump in with some examples from clients that you've been working with.
Yes, I think there are loads of examples that we have of clients that we're working with that are doing more and more on circular economy and realizing that they can link this to their performance on carbon, biodiversity, and other goals. Many of those are still keeping it quite quiet, interestingly, on the broader market. So they might not be sharing externally at this stage about the work that they're doing. But for example, a global restaurant chain that is looking at the circularity of their fit out. So all of the materials that go into the development of their restaurants, the tables, the furnishings, how can they make that more sustainable and more circular? Fit out is classically a very wasteful type of construction. We have very, very fast turnaround times. That interior might only be in some cases, 5 years. So what we do with the materials that come out really matters. And as they're doing that, we're helping them to quantify their carbon impact in addition to the circularity that they're achieving and looking at how that's going to impact on cost. And in many cases, it's going to actually help them reduce the cost significantly over time.
Maybe I could add another example to what Susan has been explained. And we've had quite a long-term relationship with the pharma company Ferré. And we actually helped them to commit to reduce by 25% the carbon footprint of their whole packaging by 2025. And they have decided to do that through their sustainable packaging model. And one of the key areas that they have been successful in is establishing this direct relationship and collaboration with their providers, because they have recognized them being specifically important to reach that goal. So I think that this is a clear example that highlights that new way of doing things. So partnerships are very important, both upstream and downstream of the supply chain. And this highlights really the importance of considering all the agents in your supply chain to be successful in your net zero.
If there's time, I'd probably like to come back to one of Claudia's points around the role of digital in all of this. Around all this area, it's really easy to make for unintended consequences to arise from making the wrong decision. And so we talk quite a lot about just making sure all of that is evidenced based on a plethora of metrics that complement each other and not just one. And the way to achieve that well is to embed that into digital and just pulling back a little bit. Kind of boardrooms all over the world are dealing with two challenges at the moment. What do we do about the climate crisis and how do we make our business digital? And the feedback we're getting from these guys is we're getting transformation fatigue. We can't do both separately. We need to do them both at the same time. So the people that are tackling this really separately are going in together and saying, okay, this is how we're going to digitally underwrite the future of our business. And we're going to bake sustainability practice within to that, so it becomes part of business as usual. And we're doing quite transformational work around that right now. And for reasons probably obvious, we can't talk about it specifically, but that's the general principle. And then using that to inform those circularity decisions about the right substitution and the right design and the right model and the right time to intervene and the right disposition falls out of it. And I think that holistic piece is really exciting. It's going to keep us pretty busy over the next 5 or 10 years.
That's brilliant. Thank you. So I'm conscious that we could probably talk about this for a long time, but approaching the end of our session, I would like to ask us just to think of one commitment that we would like society or government or business to make that we think could really make a difference in terms of the sustainable production and consumption conversations we've been having today. So perhaps if I go to you first, Claudia, what do you think that commitment could be?
I think that commitment would need to be corporation along the supply chain, including the investment, because in my view, the money, the commitments, and the political will seems to be there to invest. Now we need to ensure that these are being channeled into projects that are actually enabling circular and low carbon economies, and that these projects are structured in a way that they're attractive for investment and actually receive the support they need. And this restructuring of project, I think, needs collaboration and maybe a new approach that is slowly emerging of working along the supply chain across competitive borders and across different sectors in businesses.
Thank you. Richard, what about you? What would your commitment or your ask be?
I'd like to build on the very important point Claudia made about funding and money. And I do quite strongly believe that the right initiatives within this space will look after themselves eventually and after not much time. But it's that initial phase where the sort of the business as usual can just look more attractive or not sufficiently less attractive. It's not worth making the jump and kind of weathering that disruption. So I think in that short term, the role of things like accelerators and research funds and things is super important for that initial period, just to get over that hump where business as usual is still more attractive or it's such less hassle not to change, right up into the point where these things take care of themselves and become the new norm. So I think it's that timing piece is really critical.
Thank you. And Susan?
Yeah, as you can probably imagine in my job, this is something I spend a lot of time thinking about. And I think there are many things that we can do. But one thing I've been thinking a lot about at the moment is the value and importance of setting targets for resource use like we do for carbon. When we look at the success that has come, the uptake that has come with science-based targets for carbon, with internal carbon pricing, we can see that that model of a science-based indexed kind of global contribution has made real inroads and has been understandable and clear across different levels of business and government. So I think that that would help to moderate consumption, but it would also help to foster innovation, to find the solutions that can achieve the decoupling of resource that we need. So that I think is something that I hope we'll see in the near future.
Thank you. And Berta?
Yeah, I would just like to add some point on what Richard and Susan have said, and is that companies sometimes they really need to know what are the frameworks for reaching that scenario or reaching to net zero and fighting climate change. Sometimes the tools are out there and it's just a question of approaching those to them and being clear on what they need to do. So there are frameworks they can start with. Sometimes the problem that they find is that they don't know where to start in. And the good news is that we can really make use of all these tools and all that knowledge, and especially some sectors that have been accelerating that step forward, and we can learn from them. So there are tools, and I think that there has to be this commitment of making them more strong and more accessible to all the companies.
Thank you. And on my behalf, I think it's been impossible to ignore the demand from society for an urgent response. There's a real demonstrable movement, I think, from societies globally in the lead up to COP and during the COP event itself that clearly shows that responsible production and consumption of resources, including materials and fuel sources, chemicals, water, energy, all of the things we've been talking to today, is actually front of mind for the global citizens. And so the commitment I would like to see from business and citizens, but also from government, is to realise the opportunities that we've been talking about today and fast forward on innovation plans.
Thank you so much for all your thoughts and for sharing your experiences with us as part of this Wise Folk in Waste podcast. It was great to hear from everybody. If you've enjoyed listening to this debate, then you can find more about COP from other Anthesis colleagues on our website at anthesisgroup.com/COP-26. And you can also access the other Wise Women in Waste episodes on there. We'd love to hear your views on the topics that we discuss. So if you'd like to feature on one of the future episodes, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn or via email. Until then, thank you so much to our panel and lovely colleagues, and thank you for listening.